Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? We got an interesting.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
And that's Carol the Coach. Hi, I am Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and I am hosting the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show, where we learn about hope, strength, and recovery. And I am so happy to be with you here tonight. I mean, this gives me so much gratitude to be able to disseminate information that I think will be helpful, and maybe to take that slant whereby you might have an issue and you're afraid to talk about it because you're afraid of somebody's judgment. You don't want to be called a freak. You don't want others to laugh, and so you don't share it with anybody. And this is the show where you can call in. Our number is 646-595-3284, and I welcome your calls. You can call in and talk about what may be plaguing you or affecting you and your relationships. You know, I work with sex addicts, and I'd say 80% of them are in relationship with somebody else. 20% are probably all by their lonesome. They're afraid of relationships. And so that sexual addiction has replaced any possibility for them to develop a meaningful and intimate relationship with somebody else. And so it's my job to help people to figure out what they need to do to change their life. And tonight we have John and Elaine Leadham, and they are, well, the Leadhams are clinical psychiatric social workers who have made it their mission to help people in recovery. And I think what is just so wonderful about them, if you've listened to the show, you know that they're on at least once a month. What is so wonderful is they lead by example. No pun intended with their names, the Leadhams. I'm not kidding you. These folks have done the work. They allow others to know that they've done the work, and they have spent over 60 years actually closer to 75, I think, but they've spent that time with other couples, with other people, helping them to find recovery and serenity and peace. And, you know, tonight, John and Elaine are going to be talking about, well, they're going to be talking about something that I think is very prevalent in a sex addict's life. They are going to be talking about the fact that it is not our partners that are the problems. You know, they've learned that to simply regret past misbehavior does nothing to change one's life. And in fact, the lessons of recovery have taught them that if you don't really create the infrastructure you need to support your life, if you aren't really committed to making the changes that you need to make, you will fall again. And they found that this principle seems to hold true in all areas of life, including romantic relationships. So, if you end up repeatedly feeling like you're not getting your needs met, and you wonder why are you doing the same things over and over again in partnership, then they say, hey, the common denominator is you, and they're going to be talking about that. So many of you may know that they've written One in the Spirit, and that is a couple's meditation guide to recovery. And they are in process of writing another book that we'll be real excited to see, hopefully this spring. They'll have to keep us updated and find out exactly when they hope to have that finished. But, again, what I love is that they don't point the finger at each other. They point the finger at themselves, and they say, what do I need to learn? What do I need to change? And they've taken their own personal experiences and years and years and years of working with addicts, anybody who has multiple addictions, and they've created a safe environment to figure out what is it that you can change about yourself that will actually create the desire and the need for what you really want in your life. So I'm looking forward to talking with them. They should be on at about 9:15 tonight. In the meantime, you know, I had a client a couple of days ago, well, two of them, and they came in, and he had just been out of recovery, out of a recovery rehab center, and he couldn't get a word in edgewise because his wife was so shell-shocked and damaged by what she believed was a personal assault on herself and, of course, the relationship, that she was into controlling every word that was spoken in the session. And if there are therapists listening tonight, you know what that's like. When somebody is so wounded that they just absolutely take over the session and they want to express how angry they are, and usually they do that in terms of control. And, you know, this woman admitted, yes, I GPS his car. Yes, I have him followed by a private investigator. Yes, I keystroke his computer. Yes, I have software for his phone. I mean, she was 100% trying to control the situation so that she would gain as much information as possible to then be able to assess the situation. Now, does that sound like you or your partner? You know, spying on your partner is very, very common. And there's a whole wealth of therapists who believe that once somebody has had an indiscretion, then they should be an open book for their partner. And they should give them all the passwords. I believe that, too. I think that's one of the ways to create healing. But so oftentimes what I do see is that there is so much hypervigilance and paranoia that the partner doesn't get to focus on herself or himself, and it also takes away from the addict working on him or herself. And so tonight we're going to be talking about how can you relax and refocus on yourself. And I know that can seem terribly, terribly threatening because you don't want to miss anything. If you're the partner, you don't want to think that things are happening to you, and you're not aware of that. But there are many, many tools that a partnership can use, and I'm telling you, One in the Spirit, Meditation Course for Recovering Couples, written by John and Elaine Leadham, is a day-by-day guide as to what you can do to enhance your relationship as opposed to chip away at it. And I always say that what you appreciate appreciates. And what that means is that when you start focusing on what it is that you appreciate about your partner, whether he's a sex addict, whether she's a sex addict or not, you will help to balance all the fear and the anger and the sadness that has evolved out of a relationship where addiction is involved. And so I cannot highlight enough how important it is to really keep the scales a little bit more balanced by deciding, you know, hey, where do I contribute to this problem? Whether you're the addict or the co-sex addict. Or to say, hey, what do I like about this relationship? What is working? Again, our number is 646-595-3284. And you can feel free to call in anytime during the show and ask your questions or share your own situation. Because it is very difficult when you're in crisis or when you feel defeated. It is very difficult to focus on the positives or ask yourself what's working or thank somebody when he or she is honest about a feeling, a slip, a tough situation. And at the same time, that's what's absolutely necessary to maintain recovery. And I cannot advise enough that, you know, your relationship is your responsibility and you have to figure out what works in the relationship and what you need to work on and how you can stay separate from your partner and what you can do to get healthy. And that's why 12-step programs are so important. You know, I talked to you last week about running a group, and what is so amazing is that in my men's group, the men really talk about what they need to do to stay healthy themselves. And that may look like, you know, doing some psychotherapy regarding their feelings and writing anger letters and letting go of their anger and creating an environment for forgiveness in their own lives, in their family of origin's life, with their brothers or sisters or aunts or uncles, whatever. And then what can they do to bridge the gap in their relationships with other people? As opposed to focusing on what's going wrong, what's going right. And, you know, I always say, you always ask yourself, what did you do to contribute to the problem and what can you do to change that? Because if you don't take responsibility and accountability, and if you don't develop those empathy skills, which are so necessary when you're working with others, you know, whether you're in a relationship right now, you're in a divorce situation, but you're sharing kids, you know, you've always got to ask yourself, hey, what can I do to make this a better relationship? And what can I do to make myself healthier and whole? And so I really would ask you to take a serious look at yourself, and let's face it, the 12 steps help you to do that. They help you to identify your character defects. They help you to decide what you can do to right the wrong. And for anybody who may be listening for the first time, what I, as a certified sexual addictions therapist, promote is seeing somebody who has a lot of expertise in addictions and encouraging 12-step involvement, because it provides that infrastructure to stay healthy, and get yourself a sponsor, somebody that has a lot of recovery, that you like what they're doing, and then to do the work, read the right books, spend time in situations with other healthy couples. And if you're by yourself and you're sitting here thinking, I wish I had somebody in my life, know that if you do these steps, you will indeed find somebody that resonates with you, that you can share your life with. But you have to really work on yourself first And that's the guarantee. You work on yourself, your life will be fuller. So I encourage you to really spend time doing the work, and that can be tough. Sometimes that's a 3 to 5 year process. So I want to welcome John and Elaine to the show. John and Elaine, are you on the line?
Good evening.
Hello, we're here.
Yay. Well, how are you both doing?
We are good. I have a brief health disclaimer. If I should start a coughing fit, since I am having an asthma attack tonight, don't call my name. Elaine will pick up.
All right. You just put yourself on mute, and Elaine and I will just go on, and you just come back on when you're feeling better. I'm sorry to hear that. That's really tough.
Well, it's okay. My spirit is in a good space. We both are, actually.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And tonight, you're going to be talking about partners are not the problems. Is that correct?
It is.
Yeah. So, John, say a little bit about what made you decide that this topic would really resonate with our listeners.
Well, probably it begins, as most of our work does, with our own life experience. We went from one partner to the next, believing the adage of the 70s, and that was that we must have had a broken picker. That's why we were selecting the wrong mates. When the reality was, there were changes that each of us, specifically me, I know, needed to make if I were going to be able to have a successful, healthy, sober romance. I kept thinking it was my partner that was the problem, and kept switching from one relationship to the next, not realizing that the problem was in part me, and I was merely switching seats on the Titanic, as it were.
Mm-hmm. So, and Elaine, were you finding that John was doing this, or did you see the same thing with you?
Oh, I certainly, Carol, saw the same thing with myself. I mean, one of my situations in terms of romance, especially prior to John, was to make sure that I never was without a partner, to in fact have sequential partners available, lined up, and not being in happy or contented in relationships, but realizing, like John had mentioned, whether or not it was that I just picked poor people to, you know, be in a relationship with, or would blame them, but certainly would have much of the experience that John was talking about. And then when I met John, I had a lot of things to criticize or to see in him that I thought was rather imperfect.
Well, and there's that old standard adage that when we see something in someone else, it really does lie within us too. So you're big believers in taking a look at yourselves and focusing on each one of you individually and not the other person.
Correct.
Well, yes.
So,
that's for sure.
Yeah, and you actually are writing, you know, certainly you've written One in the Spirit, Meditation Course for Recovering Couples, but you're writing another book that's going to highlight some of these concepts.
Yes, we are. In fact, we had a chance recently in a community in the Midwest, Oklahoma area, to present some of the preliminary work that we've done on awakening to your soulmate, a decision to be in love, and introduce to a group of about 20 or 30 couples the core concepts of being what we call in love, which is different than being in love, because it requires that couples really show up and participate in each other's recovery in a variety of ways. The book should be available for publication by the end of 2013. We are working aggressively on it, but they are works of love and take a long time.
Okay, so it won't be out in the spring. We're going to probably have to wait till the end of next year.
Probably.
It may very well work out that way, Carol.
Well, now tell me a little bit about, you know, so many of our clients tend to have true regret and remorse, but that does not alone change people. So why do you think so many people feel like if they have that remorse and regret, that in itself will be enough?
Well, I know for many people, including also myself, sometimes it started quite simply with just wishful thinking. I mean, a person will oftentimes say, I'm sorry, And sometimes it's just off the cuff. Sometimes it's very sincere. It's very genuine. But the truth is, I know from my own experience and what people will share with me when I work with them, they're looking for relief, you know, and really waiting for that moment of just getting that relief of you accepting my apology. And once that relief is received, oftentimes the next step, which is necessary, which is making change, that is avoided, or that is, you know, person will make a decision they don't need to change because, hey, I've been forgiven. There's a lot of fear, as we all know, in terms of making changes in ourselves and looking at ourselves in a way that elicits the feeling of vulnerability, and most people want to avoid that.
Well, and I know that you oftentimes use the line, the person I was will fall again, meaning what, John?
Well, it's an adaptation from writing that Bill Wilson did, the founder of AA, in a book called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. He says, as he's introducing the idea of our defects of character, that the person I was will drink again. And if we think about that in terms of romantic relationships or emotional challenges in our life, if I handle it the way I always handle it, I will get what I always got. excuse me. Typically what I would do, and it was certainly a part of my active love and sex addiction, I am in recovery from that as well as alcoholism, it was certainly a part of that, but it is fairly common in our society for couples to move from one relationship to the next with the expectation that the problems in the previous relationship were largely to do with choosing the wrong partner or not being able to get over the things that we found wrong in the other person. The message that the person I was will fail again says to our clients, and that we say to each other as well, that to merely regret and have remorse for the ways that we have behaved doesn't necessarily result in a change. You know, I'm sorry used to flow off my tongue like water off a duck's behind. I genuinely meant it, but I had no idea about how to not repeat the same behaviors. So if I remained the same person, I was probably going to fall again.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why we see so many couples that say, I'm sorry, over and over and over again. And again, you're right, they absolutely mean it. But that's not going to be enough to be able to improve the relationship and improve their own sense of self. They've got to be able to work on themselves and really take a good, hard look at what they need in their life to maintain and sustain a change. So, now, to me, this makes so much sense. But when something's wrong in a romantic relationship, why do so many people feel that the responsible person is their partner? They just don't get that it could start with them. They're the common denominator.
Well, when you think about it, as early as, you know, when we're very young and as children, Carol, you know, a lot of times one of the first things that a person will say once they can, my own granddaughter I'm thinking of as I'm answering this question, is, I didn't do it, or he did it. And she's barely three, and she's already saying that. She did it. I didn't do it. So it's not an uncommon thing for us to do, which means that we would blame somebody else or project it onto somebody else, try to deflect it from ourselves. And I really do believe that it's that fear that we have of really looking at ourselves, and also many times just that fear or anxiety about, I don't really know what to do. You know, so many times I find that people have the desire to do something different, to change themselves, but they really clearly, especially in romantic relationships, just don't know what to do. You know, today, in fact, was another time when I was working with a client. That was exactly what came out of her mouth. I don't know what to do, so therefore I do nothing. And she was referring to her relationship with her partner.
So what kind of advice did you give her to role model healthy behaviors?
Well, in this situation, this individual has a fairly extensive trauma history, and so with her work, I needed to talk to her more about how so much of her trauma reactions creates that feeling of helplessness and hopelessness in her. So one of the things I first had to do was to address some of the trauma reactions she was having and try to separate that out from what she was telling herself, which is, I really don't know what to do. Once we were able to kind of calm down some of the more reactive feelings that she was having, you know, it was quite interesting, Carol. She came to understand with our conversation that she did have some healthy strategies by herself, within herself, of what to do. It was just that she became frozen and believed, again, that she was helpless and she couldn't do something. And so once that was moved through, you know, we started to move through some of that, she said, well, I guess I really could tell him how I feel. Now, that might sound quite elementary, but that was the starting point of what she needed to do. And then to move also through that, as many times as she keeps hearing herself or telling herself, I should say, I don't know what to do, she's believing that, and she's becoming more immobilized rather than empowered.
Right, I was just going to say that disempowers her.
Yes, and it does.
Obviously, if she shares her feelings, that's powerful.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, also to listen to what we say to ourselves. How many times do we say things like that to ourselves and think that we get away with it, and we don't get away with it because that's actually what we believe. We start to really believe and then, therefore, act out, live by.
Yeah, you know, Wayne Dyer says that we have 60,000 thoughts a day, and most of them are negative and disempowering.
Yes.
And so that is one way we can be responsible and have adaptive coping mechanisms. So you and John are both working individually with clients, and then you do couples work. Is that correct?
Yes, quite extensively.
Mm-hmm. Yes, say a little bit more about that, John.
Okay. excuse me.
Sure.
We, out of our practice, both of our practices in Toms River and in East Brunswick, we have couples intensives available as well as couples retreats that we will either contract with a treatment facility to provide for them, or we will, in the case of our recent trip to Oklahoma, contract with a group of people within an area to bring the message of hope in sober romantic relationships.
And so it is through that, obviously, doing the workshops together that you can work with several couples. And I would assume they would learn from each other as much as learn from you.
Yes, that's very much a part of the process, Carol. I mean, you know, people that have participated in group therapy-like experiences will often share that, you know, everybody really becomes a student in that circle that you're working within, and everybody gains. So that does happen as well in our couples work that we do with the groups. We've been doing this for quite a while, and we really do enjoy being able to bring this process of empowerment and this process of a sober romance within the couples that we work with.
Yeah, and, you know, Elaine, earlier you referenced fear and anxiety playing a role in how people relate to each other or the disempowerment that can occur. And certainly, whenever there's an addiction, you know, you've got two people that are feeling fear. So it would make sense that fear plays a role in our wanting to hold the other partner responsible for the problems in the romantic relationship. I mean, it keeps us from having to work on ourselves, and maybe deep down inside, we don't think that we are capable of doing that. So what sort of strategies do you and John typically use to empower people to face their fear and to look at themselves?
Well, our book that you referenced before, One in the Spirit, that book is really chock full of many, many strategies that we talk about, pulling from the themes that we work off, the 52 themes in the book. But more specific to right now, one of the things that I remember, quite frankly, it was John that brought the idea into our relationship over 20-some years ago, was to have that sense of a higher power in our relationship. And when I use that term, I mean, it could be anything from goodness to wholeness to God to higher power, but anything, meaning that for me, when I have a discussion with John, whether it is something where I am angry with him or whether I'm just wanting to share myself or no matter what the experience is that I'm trying to share with John, how awesome and how powerful it is when I'm willing to bring forth my best self, the way that I speak personally, because this is meaningful to me, I will say to have the God within me to be alive and present, you know, really to the point that hopefully my desire is that John can actually see or experience that in me. But to realize that bringing my best self and drawing upon that power from wherever that person has it, to have that be the center of the relationship rather than it just be me or my will or I've got to get my way. And so that is one of the strategies that we will often talk to couples and be able to work with them around that and for them to bring their own personal definition of what that level of goodness or wholeness or godlike behavior looks like and feels like for them.
I know I was getting ready to say now, for your own personal self, because I think clients really find it helpful to know what we recommend or what we do for ourselves. I mean, do you meditate and focus in on the godness inside of you, or do you actually have a vision where you experience breathing in God, knowing that God is inside you at all times? But what is it that you do that taps into your godlike quality?
Well, I know for myself, I use a lot of different types of strategies and a great deal of variety of tools. You know, I enjoy using guided imagery.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy using music. I enjoy a variety of authors that I read from spiritual, that write spiritual fables, to actual books on spirituality that touch me. I use nature a lot. I mean, there is nothing like taking a walk for me every day. We're so fortunate that we live by the water and to walk out to a certain spot every day in, you know, on the water and to just bring that feeling of wholeness and a higher power right into my soul. Daily journaling and prayer and meditation is absolutely a part of our daily practice. And what I've really been fortunate and what I have found is that what I used to be afraid of when I worked with clients is that I would maybe even come across as offensive by using the word God or higher power or spirituality. And thankfully, I have found the opposite to be true, because really what I'm asking people to look at is what is your best self or the essence of your best self. And if they're stuck, Carol, and they can't find that person, or they say to me, I have no idea who that person is, usually if we go back into very early childhood and try to find a moment or moments in their lives where they really felt good in and of themselves, that's where we begin and start to build from there.
Yeah, very true, Elaine. I was working with a couple today, in fact, Carol, that in this case the addict, had concealed from his spouse for some time challenges that he was experiencing in his recovery, that he was so afraid of his partner finding out about that he developed a denial process, which to his partner looked like the same old, let's call him Ralph, was lying and misrepresenting and manipulating. And as we began to drill into the dynamics during that session, it was really Ralph's fear of becoming the person he used to be that he was keeping from his partner. He didn't so much dread her knowing about his behavior or his thoughts, but he dreaded becoming that person again. And so denial is not simply a way of manipulating others from seeing who we are. It's a way in which we become manipulated by our addictive process to not be able to see ourselves. And the fear of being that character resulted in some really deceitful behavior that took quite a toll in terms of the quality of trust in the relationship. But it's one of the ways that fear will grip a relationship and bring communication to a halt.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a double whammy, because obviously when you're dealing with an addiction, you've got your own internalized fears, but when there's a relationship involved, it seems to magnify the fear. You not only worry about your own sense of self, but you worry about what someone thinks of you, and that's why the rules seem to be different in romance. Can you agree?
That's one of the reasons why we tend to blame the other person in the relationship for the problem, because when we view ourselves outside of the romantic relationship, we seem to be very adaptive. We seem to be very cordial and thoughtful and introspective and capable of real identification with the people that we interact with. It might be very easy, as an example, to develop very open communications with members of our support group at a 12-step meeting of some kind, go home, and because that relationship is much more intimate and that relationship is much more risky, begin to see our partner as the problem and not what we are thinking, feeling, or how we are coping.
Mm-hmm. And I assumed, because, you know, I typically ask you to give me a bit of a topic, when you said that the topic was going to be the problem is not my partner, I really, when I read that, I thought, you know, that's not just the addict thinking that the co-sex addict is the problem, but it goes both ways. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
so,
sure. I'm sorry.
No, continue, Elaine.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, it's mutually expressed when I'm working in a couple session, for instance, where the person will start their statement with, if only my partner would, mm-hmm. you know, and then fill in the blank. So it really doesn't matter if it's the addict or the partner married to the addict. Both people will project it upon the other person and really believe
yeah.
it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we were talking strategies earlier, and I know in your book, One in the Spirit, Meditation Course for Recovering Couples, you share that individuals in a relationship can use the Serenity Prayer as a coping skill when issues become difficult and they want to work on the intimacy. So, you know, I'd love to hear more about that. How do you see the Serenity Prayer really being a tool for couples?
Well, really what the Serenity Prayer, what it provides is a course of action for the couple if they choose to use. And as you know, a key part of the Serenity Prayer, the last part asks us to have the courage to change the things I can and the wisdom to know the difference. It really does call upon focusing on the only thing that really can be changed, which is yourself. You know, to move out of that mindset of if my only partner would, and to look at what you really can change, which is yourself. That's really what we are all capable of changing. That's the only thing we truly have any power over in terms of change. And then the way, you know, that we deal with ourselves and the way that we deal with our partner, that's truly what's going to bring us that sense of peace and serenity into our experience with them. So it really crystallizes that focus that we believe so much in, Carol, which is the only thing you truly can change is yourself.
Well, and obviously that's why support groups, 12-step groups, are so instrumental in keeping you focused on what can you change about yourself. And, you know, Indianapolis, which is where I'm based out of, is this huge city. And they have many AA and Al-Anon groups, and they have many SAA groups and a couple of COSA groups. We don't have any SA or S-Anon groups. Do you know the difference between those two groups, SAA and SA?
We do, but it would not be appropriate, I'm afraid, for us to go into any length of a description between the two groups, because it would present us as authorities on
okay.
the subject, and we are not.
Okay.
If you had specific questions, we could share our professional experience with that.
Well, I do have one because I heard it today, and again, because I am not real versed. I've read the white book, but I'm not really versed. I had a couple that said that SA believes in God, whereas SAA believes in a higher power, which leaves more room for other higher powers. And I wondered if you found that to be true.
I have not. I, in my experience with people who attend either fellowship, they are introduced to the idea of a God as we understand him or it or her to be,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily as a capital G-O-D. I think higher power works more comfortably for people that have issues related to organized religion, to God, perhaps more comfortable, a source of focus for those who are comfortable with their childhood religions or the religions of their adulthood. I think the wisdom in referring to one's higher power as a God as we understand him was, I think, early AA's attempt to make it a program of inclusion as opposed to exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been very easy to alienate folks who wanted to believe in a particular philosophy or theology. I don't know that the SA and SAA groups differ in the idea of a power greater than self or God as we understand him.
Okay. Well, when I heard that, I was not aware of that, and so I thought, I think that's something that I probably should know about, and you two are experts in 12-step philosophy, and as a matter of fact, even after I said that, I know that there is, obviously, we're not advertising 12-step groups, and certainly you don't want to be considered an expert, because that is that's why AA and SAA and SA have been so well endorsed, because they are all individually based, and it's what the person believes about that. So I appreciate the fact that you got that boundary.
But we were talking
about the Serenity Prayer, and I just was curious what you thought, because I know my clients are always looking for guidance and advice in regards to 12-step meetings and what really works, and you're a proponent of 12-step meetings for sure.
We are indeed, and what I would caution your clients about if they were sitting in front of me
mm-hmm.
is that the program of AA or the program or SAA or SA really resides in the 12 steps of that program and not so much in what happens at a particular meeting, because a meeting will have its own personality. And a particular group may be very pro-X or very pro-Y, and it can get a little confusing at times, especially if your clients are new to the 12-step process. They might determine that the SAA fellowship says this is what we believe in, when it's really an outspoken member of a particular meeting that they attended.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Now, I'm curious, what kind of guidance or advice can you offer to our listeners, or to an individual who keeps finding himself or herself at the end of another romantic relationship? You know, if it is true that they're the common denominator, then what can they do about changing the outcome of that next relationship, which of course means what can they do about working on themselves?
One of the things that we encourage couples at the conclusion of a relationship to do
mm-hmm.
is to undertake a focused four-step. The four-step in whatever the 12-step fellowship you might belong to says the same thing. We took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We encourage couples to do a focused romantic four-step inventory in which they look at all of the relationships, the romantic relationships that they have been in, and how they have been hurt and how they have wronged others, and what are the common defects of their character or maladaptive coping strategies in their personal story that they really should address before moving into another romance. You know,
saying that's at the end of their relationship. They should take that four step.
Yes, very much so. And prior to the beginning of a new relationship, to see what it is that they are able to learn from where they came. During the height of my love and sex addiction, one of my solutions to the problem, as I saw it, was to run away and try to become a priest. And and I got blocked in my attempt to do that by the grace of God and a priest by the name of Father Joe, who said, you know, I really think you ought to stay out of relationships until you don't need to be in one. And I thought he'd be an arrogant, self-righteous man who stood in the way of my calling to the altar. I think he was really a spokesperson for God, because that was incredible advice for me. That was very powerful advice. And I resented him, but I followed the advice and was able to get sexually and romantically sober as a result of staying out of relationships until I could find out why I changed every time I got in one. And that's part of what we will guide couples through, or individuals coming out of the end of a relationship that was unproductive.
So why did you change every time you got into a relationship?
Well, it leads back to the question we were talking about earlier, in so much that romantic relationships are probably the most vulnerable relationships that we can be in. If there are childhood traumas, if there are familiar problems that haven't been addressed, emotional injuries that have been endured, the very most likely place for those memories or post-traumatic flashbacks to occur will be in a romantic relationship, because of the vulnerable nature of what happens in intimacy, not just in a sexual encounter, but day in, day out, in a relationship, you will begin to experience some of the very worst of the memories that you have based in childhood experiences, traumatic events, and some of the very worst of your defects of character. Romantic relationships are like petri dishes to our defects of character.
And Elaine, do you want to elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, I'm sorry, he just started to...
You let me know if you need to help him.
No, I just got a little bit distracted, truthfully, because I could hear what was starting to happen. No, in terms of what he was talking about with the vulnerability and everything, I know for myself, oftentimes I would become a chameleon in relationships, kind of just sit back and wait and see what kind of role do I need to take on in order to be able to save or to stay in this relationship. You know, oftentimes it was really driven from my fear of being rejected, and therefore I would settle for more of a superficial relationship and taking on, like I said, different parts or different roles, like the caretaker might be one example of that, rather than to be real and authentic, and then wonder why the relationship either felt unfulfilling to me or would fall apart, or there would be some kind of challenge or problem to it that would eventually drive me away.
Well, that makes sense, and that chameleon attitude or thinking is very codependent. I mean, it just definitely is hardwired to want to please somebody else. And it sounds like you were afraid of conflict.
Afraid of conflict, but, you know, afraid of conflict, afraid of rejection, anything. So to avoid conflict, I would just, like I said, take on a different role, or I would not communicate my feelings, for instance. And then what happens usually is that the emotions would build up so much to a boiling point, and then the way that I would eventually express it would be inappropriate, oftentimes hurtful, and out of context even sometimes, and cause either greater harm, because I was more focused on trying to avoid conflict and avoid being rejected and hiding my feelings, rather than deciding that I wanted to have a real relationship with somebody. You know, one of the things that we find often, Carol, and again, it's something that I experienced myself until I decided to change, is that I spent more time wishing for the type of relationship I wanted than working for the type of relationship I wanted. I would put, or other people will share, they'll put more time into their jobs or into their role as parents or whatever than they will into their romantic relationship. And everything we know about romantic relationships, you know, building upon what John was saying earlier about the fact that, you know, it's the most intense and it has the greatest threat of, in terms of feeling vulnerable, is that it's a lot of work and it requires a lot of work. And so we don't build our day around all the other stuff we have to do and then as a sidebar look at our relationship, it's the other way around. And that's a whole different mindset for people to decide that they want to undertake, that my relationship is a primary rather than all the other things in my day.
Well, and you know, I almost think that because our partners can feel like an extension of us, more oftentimes than not only are they not giving the relationship the time that they need, but they're also not giving themselves the time they need to read and to study and to reflect and assert and become aware, and it's a whole ball of wax that does nothing but spiral out of control. So I would agree 100% that, yeah, it makes sense that if you've got somebody who is unhappy with their relationship, they have to put the work into it, and they've got to make the time. They've got to give it the attention.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't be surprised at all, Carol, you know, basically that you do the same similar type of work that we do. But, you know, we'll have couples come in that will be in great disrepair, their relationship, and to get them to agree upon being able to devote 15, at maximum 30 minutes a day simply to, you know, their relationship, it almost becomes unbearable to them to be able to find that time and actually to make a commitment to do that. And this is beyond that what we all know about everybody being afraid of doing this. This is just logistics because their days have become so jam-packed, and it really highlights the truth, which is the relationship was kind of just rolling along, and they were settling for that, and they can't really even find 15 minutes that they can agree upon that they can spend together, alone, uninterrupted.
And I, for one, would not give up the 45 minutes to an hour that Elaine and I spend every single morning reading spiritual material, journaling, sharing our journal entries with each other, and being available to give each other feedback. No one is going to know me as well as my partner or know that I'm in trouble sooner than my partner will. And those daily investments are invaluable.
And so you actually have the time commitment of 45 minutes to an hour each day for self-reflection with your partner and then sharing that as needed.
And we get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do that.
Yeah, it's true. And it's what, you know, it takes from what you were sharing, Carol, which is there really is a need to have some time to yourself and to be able to be reflective and meditative in your own way. So part of that is with our own individual work, you know, journaling and reading. And
mm-hmm.
The other part is with the sharing of that and the share of, we choose also to bring prayer into that, but the sharing of our journaling that we wrote, as well as giving each other support and feedback if that's necessary at the time.
So I was going to ask you, you know, what were some important strategies that you think can actually increase the coupleship, and that is definitely one of them, to find the time. And Elaine, you said 15 minutes minimum, and John, you said you would never give up your 45 minutes to an hour with Elaine for the sake of yourself and your relationship. Can you think of any other strategies that would help couples to get in alignment with each other?
Well, it may seem like an odd couple strategy, but we practice and we encourage the couples that we work with to practice sharing their experience, strength, and hope with other couples. If you have a recovering couple that you see in the rooms as struggling or floundering to some degree or not having the joy in their relationship that they might individually demonstrate in their respective recoveries, reaching out to that couple, trying to carry the message of the promises and how they are being fulfilled in your lives together, will give in return back to you so many times. We learned in early recovery, many of us, that the best insurance against the next drink or the next acting out behavior was service to others. That's true for recovering couples as well. Have dinner parties, have rotating meetings at your house, do a cover dish, bring recovery to other couples, bring recovery to other family members, demonstrate your coupleship in more familiar gatherings, Thanksgiving Day, birthday parties, those kinds of things. Don't pair off and go watch the football game, or for the gals to go in the other room and talk about the things that interest the females, and stay together as a couple during those family relationships. That will enhance the quality of your union. We invite each other to give the other person input on a regular basis. Elaine has absolute say over whether or not I am doing enough for my recovery. I have absolute say as to whether or not she is doing enough. We don't necessarily have a dictate on what has to be done, but both of us are able to say to the other, you know, you're really not doing enough given the challenges that are going on in your life right now. First reaction is typically one of resentment or to become defensive, but if Elaine says it's time for you to go to a meeting, I'm going to a meeting. I'll worry about defending myself later.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where using the other person as an extension of yourself is so helpful. And, you know, certainly a lot of philosophies say, no, that's you being in somebody else's inventory or doing their inventory. But what you're really saying is when you love and care for somebody, you want to know if their feedback is that they're not seeing you and doing as many healthy things as you could be doing.
Right.
Well, who would really know better when you think about it? I mean, really, who really knows better? I mean, today I had an opportunity, you know, John was not feeling well at work with, you know, like he shared, with having the asthma reaction and everything. And I was quite concerned about how it was impacting him and emotionally how he was handling himself. And instead of just thinking this to myself, showing up in a relationship means going to him privately, closing the door, asking him, sharing my concerns with him based on the response he gave me, and then, you know, talking to him about what do you want to do with this? How do you want to handle this? That is really just showing up for your partner. And that seems like a small example, Carol, but that's really a decision that I made in this relationship finally after falling on my face numerous times. And that no matter if the situation is small or large, that the decision is that I'm going to show up.
Yeah, and especially for you, somebody who long time ago was afraid of rejection, for you to put yourself on the line and say, this is what I'm noticing, how can I help, really offers him an opportunity to get more feedback from the one he loves.
Right. It's amazing how much resistance I brought to this process for so long, thinking that that was an unsafe place to put myself, and how the exact opposite really has been realized by me, which is it's a very safe place to be because it's a mutual acceptance of accountability that we have decided to take on in this relationship. So I can really count on John to do the same for me. And so that has created a greater safety rather than the opposite.
I get that. And, you know, you two are inspirations to this field and to the work of recovery. And if our listeners have heard something that really resonated with them, because I send you the emails when they're saying, I just love the lead-ups. Tell me more. How might they be able to learn more about your philosophy with working with couples?
Oh, okay. Well, certainly I just wanted to start with they can certainly call our office. So that number is 732 732- 877-1444. And mm-hmm. even if they don't live by or they just want to call and ask a question, they can do that. And they really need to know that anybody that answers the phone is a clinician. So any member of our staff that answers the phone would be able to help them. Secondly, our website, which is www.leademcounseling.com, and that's L-E-A-D-E-M, counseling.com. And on there, we also have articles and some blog articles that they could draw upon if they wanted to learn more about us. The book that you've mentioned a few times and that we've mentioned, The One in the Spirit, A Meditative Guide for Recovering Couples, is another.
I want them to get that book. We are absolutely out of time, Elaine.
Okay.
But thank you, and John, and for always contributing like you do. You really are inspirations. I so appreciate it.
You're welcome, Carol, and have a great weekend. Great evening. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. There will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to follow what the Leadums have said, be your true self, and take care. We'll see you next week for another great show. Bye-bye.